from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Tui Vu, in for Michael Krasny. The brutal gang rape of a 23-year-old on a bus in India has sparked outrage not only there, but around the world and here locally. There have been vigils in the Bay Area and calls for action. Today, Indian authorities charged five of the men with kidnap, gang rape, and murder. Advocates for women say such charges are a rarity. Rapes and assaults often go unprosecuted. How common is harassment and sexual assault in India? And does it carry over when South Asians immigrate to the U.S.? In the hour ahead, we'll talk to women with firsthand experience of sexual harassment in India about why it's so pervasive and what can be done to change the culture of sexual abuse and discrimination against women. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Tui Vu, in for Michael Krasny. Her real name hasn't been revealed, but her death has sparked outrage and condemnation around the world, including here in the Bay Area. A little more than 2 weeks ago, a 23-year-old woman in New Delhi, India, and her boyfriend boarded what seemed to be a passenger bus after watching a movie. Six men gang-raped and beat her so badly, her intestines were destroyed, and she later died. Her boyfriend was also severely beaten. Sexual assaults are common in India, some say as common as mealtime every day. What's behind the problem and what can be done to help curtail it? That's our topic this morning. Our guests are Sonia Falero, author of Beautiful Thing, Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bars. Sara Khan, program director for Bay Area-based Maitri, which helps South Asian survivors of domestic violence and human trafficking. And Shalini Nadaraj, director of advocacy and partnerships with the Global Fund for Women. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Sonia, let's start with you. What do you think of the fact that five of the men are now facing kidnapping and gang rape charges? This news just came out this morning, and they could be handed the death penalty.
Well, it's just, a huge relief that they were caught, and they were caught so speedily. There were actually six men, as you know, and one is believed to be underage and is currently undergoing bone testing to see that if he can, basically testify and not end up in sort of juvenile detention for a crime that is for which there are no words. So one of the things that I talked about in my New York Times op-ed was it wasn't that the rape was incredibly brutal, because, of course, we have brutal rapes not just in India, but all over the world. I mean, violence against women is an international problem. What is remarkable about this particular rape is the outcry and the fact that this outcry has not dimmed.
Your op-ed piece came out just this week. You lived in India for 24 years and experienced sexual harassment firsthand. Tell us about your experience and how did you deal with it?
You know, the problem that we have in India, particularly in Delhi when I was growing up, certainly, was that the sexual harassment was constant. And a sexual harassment can mean catcalls. It can mean somebody making passing, comments about the clothes that you're wearing while you're walking down the street. It can mean a group of men singing a lewd song as they look you up and down. What happens is that when these incidents become daily, when it is something that a woman begins to dread, when it's a stress and a pain that she carries around all the time, the result is that that particular woman, and in fact any woman who experiences daily sexual harassment, will never have the confidence, will never have the ability, frankly, to be a complete person, to fulfill her responsibilities and her ambitions as a woman, as a citizen. So overall, when this sort of behavior is daily, what you're doing is denying half your population the ability to be complete human beings.
And in fact, I alluded to this earlier, but you are the one who said in your op-ed piece that sexual harassment is as common as mealtime every day. And in fact, there was a poll of 370 gender specialists around the world, and it voted, the specialists interviewed voted India as the worst place to be a woman. Saudi Arabia was the second worst. And Shalini Nadaraj with the Global Fund for Women, I wanted to ask you about that. What are some of the cultural reasons for this?
India among the G20, so the biggest economies of the world. So India has been ranked the worst by Trust Law, which is an arm of Thomson Reuters. And I think the reason for this goes right back to, very deeply held patriarchal and misogynistic attitudes that are prevalent in Indian society. And I have to say that this is not unique just to India, but I think there are certain cultural practices that play out in a way in India that makes it much more prevalent and deeply embedded. For instance, son preference. So you have, right from even before conception, you have a situation where girls are discriminated against. You have the horrible situation of sex determination tests to predict the sex of the unborn fetus. And so girls are aborted even before they are born. Once they are born, there are instances of infanticide in large swathes of the country. And then the girl child faces neglect with less access to nutrition, healthcare, education. So the discrimination begins from a very, very early age and continues right up to a woman's death. So if a woman is widowed, she is then discarded by the family. She's stigmatized. She has no access to the resources of her family's home. So this attitude is what has to change. I mean, the fact that the five men have been identified and charged, my fear is that then, this will disappear, that people will say, oh, give them the death penalty, hang them, and then things go back to normal. I'm hoping that the level of outrage that we have seen, people taking to the streets, for which I also think that the Arab Spring has served as an inspiration, that people feel they can do that. And to see people from different backgrounds, ages, castes, religions coming out in such numbers across the country has been gratifying, even though it is over such a horrific act.
Sarah Khan, I wanted to bring you into this conversation as well. You're the program director for Maitri. That's a Bay Area nonprofit that helps South Asian survivors of domestic violence. The attitudes that Shalini just mentioned, how much of that is carried over here to the U.S. when South Asians immigrate here? We have a large South Asian population in the Bay Area.
So the attitude is something that the way you are raised is what you're going to bring to the country when you migrate. And so the patriarchy continues. Having said that, since we deal primarily with domestic violence, I want to say that violence against women, like Sonia and Shalini both alluded to earlier, is prevalent here too. Just the way of dealing with it, the cultural part that a batterer would use to justify that continues. So you have women who are forced to select the fetus of their unborn child. You also have women who, because of immigration reasons, based on the law here, we just saw that Violence Against Women Act was not passed by the House. So people stick into horrifically violent or emotionally abusive relationships because they have nowhere else to go. And the practice across the board, all countries, of victim blaming and victim shunning, that continues. Whether they are here in the United States or whether they are in India, it's always the fault of the woman. So yes, so those things have carried over.
And when they carry over here, is it worse for the women here or is it somewhat better because of the advocacy services available to them here?
I think that it might be worse in a lot of ways because in their home countries, they would still have some sort of a family support. The isolation that people go through are devastating. The isolation is what also stops people from finding the advocacy organizations. That's why organizations like ours exist, because cultural differences are so many, and the batterer hasn't just turned around and told them that they can't go anywhere, but the patriarchy that is carried over means that a woman feels that it is her fault that her husband is not nice to her, or if she makes a move or says something, she's going to shame her family here or in the home country, or she may lose her children. So on the advocacy part, I feel like we are doing a good job. Our call count is going up. People are calling us with their problems, but that's to even just save themselves. To what a woman primarily wants, the ones that we work with, is for abuse to stop. They may not necessarily want to break their families. And since organizations like Maitri and Narika here in the Bay Area work together to help address those problems, we feel that people tend to speak out more here.
And Sonia, women are reporting more and speaking out more here. But Sonia, in India, when you were there, do women report these crimes, or they just feel like, what's the point? They're not going to be investigated anyway. These cases linger for many, many years sometimes.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think I know anybody who has ever reported sexual harassment, whether it's in public or whether it's at the workplace. And of course, we know wherever we live in the world that sexual harassment takes place, and primarily in these two areas. I think the reasons are certainly, when I was growing up and from what I hear from friends who continue living in Delhi, I've been in Bombay for the past few years, is that, number one, the cops do not take complaints of sexual harassment seriously. They may take complaints of rape seriously, but the environment of the police station is so intimidating that often it increases the sense of vulnerability that a woman feels. She feels like she's being attacked by the cops. There have been numerous cases where victims have recounted how cops have taken an almost sadistic pleasure in having them recount the incident of the rape. But let's say that the rape is recorded and investigations start. For a multitude of reasons, the investigations continue and they're haphazard. And when and if the case goes to court, the sense that the woman is somehow to blame, with repeated questions being posed to her about what she was wearing, what time she had gone out, why she was alone, whether she is in a relationship, and so on, essentially to establish that she was, to start with, a quote-unquote, a fallen woman or a prostitute, and therefore to say, well, you pretty much got what you asked for. So that sense that even if your family and society is with you, the systems are not with you. And therefore, why bother? It's better to find strength and security within your community than it is to attempt to fight for justice.
We're discussing conditions for women in India and for Indian women locally in light of the brutal gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old in New Delhi, India. It's caused outrage internationally. Our guests are Sonia Falero, author of Beautiful Thing, Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bars; Sara Khan, program director of Santa Clara-based Maitri, which helps South Asian survivors of domestic violence and human trafficking; and also Shalini Nataraj, director of advocacy and partnerships with the Global Fund for Women. We'd love to have you join our conversation about women in India. You can call us at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Or email us at forum@kqed.org. And we'll try to read some of your emailed comments from the studio as well. Shalini, how are reports of rape and sexual assault investigated in India? Are there any special laws in India against sexual assaults or harassment?
There certainly are laws, but as Sonia just said, even filing a complaint under these laws takes a lot out of women. For one thing, they fear the stigma that will come about when they come out and report the rape. We have had numerous instances of women being raped by the police. When in police custody, we have numerous reports of women being raped by the armed forces in different parts of India. So this creates a deep mistrust of going and even reporting the rape. The Global Fund for Women works with women's organizations in India. We provide them support to provide a range of services to women. And one of this is to help the woman report these crimes, get the legal counseling that she needs to get out of situations of violence, and also to demand accountability from the state, from the authorities. I think in this situation, if you're looking specifically at rape, there needs to be accountability at the very highest levels. Every political party in India has fielded candidates in the recent elections who have had charges of rape against them. There are six state legislators in the country who have charges of rape against them.
And they're still in office.
They are in office.
While facing these charges.
Yes. And as you know, these charges take years and years. Witnesses disappear, the woman is intimidated, sometimes the woman is murdered, and there's just widespread impunity. And so people feel that there is just no use in coming forward and reporting these crimes when even your local lawmaker is part of the system that is perpetuating it.
And certainly if you look at the numbers, it bears true what you're saying, because 600 rape cases were reported in Delhi in 2012, and only one led to a conviction. Out of 600 led to a conviction. Let's go to the phones. We have a lot of people who want to weigh in on this conversation. Amruta in San Jose, good morning and welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm very happy to hear that we are actually discussing this on Forum. I was raised in India, and one of the key troubles that I think in the society in India is that girls and women are raised by their very own parents and taught to tolerate, quote-unquote, incidents of sexual harassment against them. I have had several incidents where even traveling by a bus can be a nightmare. If anything happens in the bus, you know, you're touched inappropriately. Even when you report it to your parents, the immediate comment from the parents is, well, you did not dress up appropriately. Why didn't you wear something else, a little more covering? I don't think that's a solution. So there has to be a society change, a mindset change, which is going to be very hard. But I sincerely hope and pray that we get to a point where men are actually taught to respect women. It's very sad because we have so many women deities and we worship them as sources of power and knowledge and wealth, and yet such heinous crimes happen against women in India. It's very unfortunate and very sad.
Any of you care to weigh in, ladies?
She made such an excellent point, particularly when she said that in India we worship female deities and we call a woman who enters the house as a new bride the Lakshmi of the house, you know, the goddess of wealth. So even when we go back to the fact that rapes happen all over the world, this level of hypocrisy is not evident anywhere else in the world. And I think that's why it's so alarming that we have this sort of dual culture that exists, you know, welcoming a woman into the family, garlanding her, so on and so forth, and yet at the same time saying, hey, you know, when you step out of the house, you're most likely going to get touched. Men will make lewd comments. That's life. Live with it.
Yeah, and if I could add that it's not just sometimes the most unsafe place for a woman is in the house, where she is facing violence, whether it's mental abuse, physical abuse. She is being tortured because of rape, I mean, because of dowry, not bringing in enough dowry. She is raped by her husband. And of course, as we know, marital rape is just completely not even on anyone's radar screen. Women are prey to other men in the house. So a woman is actually safe nowhere, which is a very horrible situation to be in. And I really hope that having this dialogue will raise the visibility of this issue so women speak out more, break the taboos of speaking out against what's happening to them, even within their own homes.
Wanted to add to what Amruta said, you know, this traveling in a bus and feeling unsafe, something what Sonia was talking about. I think Shalini and I, also having lived in India, have been through it. But what bothers me is it being called Eve teasing. Mm-hmm. There's nothing teasing about somebody rubbing up against you in the bus and then you being 8 or 10 and made to feel that it's your fault. And so the whole victim mentality starts playing in from that time. So I think changing, calling it what it is, not Eve teasing, but it's sexual harassment or molesting, could be one of the first steps. And this has to start, like, again, from raising our children to be equal, teaching our sons to be more respectful, and speaking out for whether if they see something happening in a house, and that the woman is not a commodity to be passed on to anyone when need be.
Sarah, where does that term Eve teasing come from?
I've just heard it all my life.
Really?
I have no idea. Yes. Just like I feel like brutal rape is another oxymoron. All rapes are brutal. There's not one rape which is less brutal than the other. But Eve teasing was something we grew up.
Yeah. Right. Okay. It might be a holdover from colonial times.
Right.
I don't know.
Very interesting. I mean, it's just something that all of you have grown up with and lived with all your lives, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones and check in with Ashman from Sacramento. Good morning. Welcome
Hi.
To Forum.
Thank you. And I am so glad that you are discussing this. It is all over Facebook. I am of Indian descent, but I am from the Fiji Islands. But going back to this whole female infanticide and also when babies are aborted because they're female, I have two little girls, and I couldn't be prouder. They are the sweetest kids ever. But I've noticed this thing. There's a little bit of insecurity with my wife after the second baby was born, or since she found out that the baby was a girl. And it wasn't from anyone in our family or from her directly or me directly, but from her friends. They were saying that, hey, you know what, even if your husband doesn't say, he really wants a boy, and he may be nice to you, but then my wife got this insecurity that I might not love her as much. And so there's this whole conundrum we had that, you know, doesn't matter what, my love for you is totally separate from my love for the kids. It's not dependent on that. I loved you before the kids were there. And so we settled that, but it was there. And also I watched a few of the Indian serials. A lot of the perpetrators are women. I'm not blaming women. I think all these men should be punished severely, but I don't think that is the answer. Society has to change. Somebody has to go and say, hey, you're teasing. Stop it right now or else I'll get you in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Shalini, can you talk about both those points? I mean, do women, to a certain extent, because they were raised this way, buy into this whole concept of needing to have a son?
Oh, definitely. One of our grantees in Bangalore, Vimochana, did a women's court a number of years ago where women who had committed infanticide were actually, they testified about the situation, about why they did it. And one woman who had, it's horrible, she had killed her baby girl, and she said, I did not want her to grow up to face the same kind of situation I am facing in my life. And the other reason was that she would have been abandoned by her husband. Her husband had told her that if this next baby is a girl, then you will be abandoned. So there are, you know, ranging from that to a milder form where people feel that society will judge them for not producing a son. In Hindu, tradition, when a man dies, his son has to do the final rites, or his soul will wander the netherworld forever. That's the belief. So it's very strongly ingrained that you have to have sons. And the other thing, unfortunately, is the dowry system, where people see having sons as a money-making proposition. They can get fat dowries if they have sons. And if they have daughters, they have to pay the fat dowries. So this goes very deep, the son preference that happens in India.
And just, Sara, really quickly, before we have to go to break here, do you see that kind of sex selection happening among immigrants here as well?
So there definitely is a son preference, but I cannot speak that much to sex selection because I feel that, yes, we do have cases where women have come and said their mother-in-laws would like them to have sons. But I think here people still tend to have like the regular two family.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. We'll continue our conversation about women in India after a short break. If you'd like to join, give us a call at 866-733-6786 or email forum@kqed.org. I'm Thuy Vu, filling in for Michael Krasny. You're listening to KQED Public Radio. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Thuy Vu, in for Michael Krasny. We're discussing the reaction locally and internationally to the brutal gang rape of a 23-year-old New Delhi woman. Our guests are Sonia Falero, author of Beautiful Thing, Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bars, Sara Khan, Program Director for Santa Clara-based Maitree, which helps South Asian survivors of domestic violence and human trafficking, and Shalini Nataraj, Director of Advocacy and Partnerships with the Global Fund for Women. I'm going to go straight to the phones because we have quite a few people lined up here who would like to contribute to the conversation. And let's go now to Smita in Millbrae. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Hi, I'm Mira from San Jose.
Mira from San Jose. Well, welcome to the program. I apologize for
that. No problem. Thank you very much for taking my call. And I really like that we are talking about this. My comment was that we are talking about daughters, but we don't see the point that when the fathers are treating the mothers of those daughters differently than the daughter herself, that shows, and then the sons are there too watching, and the kids, they do, we say that, oh, we teach at home that daughters are equal and everything, but when they, the sons see their dads behaving differently with their wives, then that's a big discrepancy, and nobody thinks about it, that, and that carries on from generations, that that's how they treat, the son sees the dad treating the wife differently, and that's how all this attitude needs to change. That's what I feel.
Well, thank you for sharing that, ladies.
Absolutely. You know, I was having lunch with some friends in India recently, and my friend's mother was there. She's a lady in her 60s, and her husband was there as well. They're both retired. So she spends her whole day in the kitchen or doing chores around the house, and he is enjoying his retirement. They both worked all their working lives, but she will continue to work because if she doesn't run the house, nobody else is going to do it. And so while we were having lunch, while we were sitting down to lunch, I noticed that she served all of us, including her husband, and then she went and stood near the kitchen door. And we are talking about a very upper-class, very privileged, highly educated family.
She did not join you in the lunch. She just went back to the kitchen.
She stood by the kitchen door, and it wasn't that she was looking like she was suffering. You know, she was enjoying the conversation. She was very happy to serve us, but she did not eat herself. She watched us eat. She gave everybody second helpings. And after we'd all left, including her husband, she sat down to eat. Now, this is something that is going to tell children that there is a certain way that women must behave in mixed company, irrespective of how old they are. And it certainly, you know, it perpetuates the notion that women are subservient to men. Women serve men. And this idea of serving men is what eventually infiltrates culture as a whole and leads to various forms of harassment and ultimately rape. In India right now, I don't know if you ladies know this, but the slogan that young women are carrying, are calling out is, don't tell your daughter not to go out at night. Tell your sons to behave themselves.
And this is also sparking some interesting reactions from folks who are visiting our webpage as well. Beth writes on our webpage, I was having a discussion with one of the nurses who was caring for our son in the hospital about the situation in India. She is from India and noted with some sadness that she thought after a couple of months that the rape and death of this young woman would be forgotten by the government officials and that not much would change since change happens so slowly in India. Beth is so hoping this is not the case with this situation. The fact that the young woman was from a growing middle class where women are college educated makes her hope that their numbers will make a difference. So that was an interesting point. I want to take another caller. Let's go now to Smita from Millbrae. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you. So my comment was about Eve teasing, and I think one of your guests alluded to this a moment back, how Eve teasing is made into something, you know, light. I mean, just the name of it doesn't sound serious enough. I grew up in Delhi. I was there for 21 years, and every single day you step out the door and, you know, someone's making catcalls or lewd comments, you're in the bus, someone's touching you. But it's deeper than that. If you look at movies, if you look at media, they portray Eve teasing as something funny. I mean, there are movies where a guy is teasing the woman and then a few scenes later, the woman falls in love with that guy. I can assure you that doesn't happen in real life. And it's just taken very lightly. And the problem, I mean, I'm happy that people now at least are not showing indifference to the situation of this wave, but calling for, you know, revenge and, you know, death penalty or castration is not the only solution, because there is a lot of harassment that's going on all the time. And for that, we need to change sort of the mindset. And I guess everyone's been saying the same thing, that it's a deeper rooted problem than just one incident. But what I'm happy to see is that there isn't indifference. People are speaking up against this.
And, you know, Smita, you make an interesting point, which is also echoed by Yukti, who emailed us this simple question. What can we do to make a difference? What can we do?
Well, speaking for the Global Fund for Women, in our 25-year history, we have supported 900 organizations in 132 countries around the world who are dealing with the issue of violence against women. So I think one of the things we can do, and often these organizations are working under tremendous constraints, not only financial, but also being isolated and stigmatized by the communities that they work with. So I think one thing we can do is to find these organizations, even the organizations here in the United States. I mean, rape is a huge issue in the United States. How, you know, to stand in solidarity with them, to even reach out and say, we're here, we care about you doing this work, because this work is, it's like working in a war zone every day. And I just read somewhere that, you know, for women, there is no peacetime because, you know, they are subject to sexualized violence during war, but this carries over into the streets and into their homes. So I think even speaking out and giving whatever support we can, if it's financially or otherwise, or even just reaching out in solidarity to these organizations who are working with women, who are trying to better the situation for women and improve women's rights. I think that is one thing that we certainly can do.
Sonia?
You know, I think the most important thing that can come out of this is if all of us not just look to what's happening in India, but we look to what's happening in the rest of the world. Because I want to repeat, this girl was raped, but girls and young women and women of all ages are getting raped all over the world. Something is going wrong right now as I'm speaking. In the United States, we know that every 2 minutes, a woman is getting sexually assaulted. We know that about 94% of these assaults are not reported. We know that 99% of these rapists will not spend one night in jail. These are the figures for the United States. The best thing that can come out of this absolutely heartbreaking incident is if women all over the world say, you know what, that's India, but what's happening in our community, in our society, in our country, because we are all deeply flawed. We are damaging the woman of the world.
Very interesting. Let's take our next caller and go to Carol from Ocean Grove, New Jersey. Thank you for calling all the way from New Jersey. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you very much. I'd like to say that, first of all, culture is a really hard thing to change, and I spent 3 years setting up call centers and back office processes in India, Delhi, Bangalore, Chennai, Hyderabad, etc. And when you're trying to do this, that's when you start to see sexual harassment. As a woman, I used to see the sexual harassment played out each and every day. One of the things we did as a company is we put into our contract that all of the outsourcing companies have to abide by U.S. employment law, which included an ability to handle sexual harassment. And we also had a channel for people to tell us directly, for the employees there, to tell us directly of problems. And the problems we saw included women not being given opportunities to rise up from just being a call center rep to a team leader to a supervisor. We were constantly told that women go off and get married and it wouldn't be cost effective. And we just poo-pooed all that and said, look, you know, these are the same issues that have been brought up in the United States. We have laws against that. You have to abide by our laws or we can't do outsourcing with you. And I think if women and people in the United States said to American companies, you have a responsibility, you have to apply the same standards when you're outsourcing, you have to ensure that those same standards of work that happen in the United States happen in those countries, then we'd start to see a difference. You can bet that there was a difference for the women who worked for us.
Carol, just out of curiosity, was your company headed by a man or a woman?
It was headed by a man. The leader of our division was a woman.
Very interesting. So what do you think about that? We've talked a lot about the cultural reasons for why sexual assaults are so common in India. What about corporate responsibility? What role does that play, and what role should it play?
I think as far as corporate responsibility, I will talk about not outsourcing, but corporate responsibility here in the United States. Maitri was formed in 1991, given into the need of the Bay Area at that time, which was we had a lot of people who came from India and other South Asian countries on a what is called an employment visa, which is an H-1B. And then there is a derivative dependent visa that they could bring their spouses on. The person who came on a dependent visa was here in this country legally, but had primarily no other rights. So that gave a lot of power and control to the spouse. And that's where we saw the escalation in the violence in the house. We did try and talk to the corporations, but we were told to take it to the state level and the federal level. So we end up, like Shalini said, we are a very small nonprofit and end up doing more of the crisis intervention work, and the policy work kind of took a backstage. So I feel that people could, if the corporations stepped up and decided these laws would also play into people who came here on dependent visas, we would definitely see a steep decline in violence.
So one of the things that actually a man that I know put forward shortly after the story of the gang rape broke, he said that I think, companies and state entities should divest from investing in India till something is done to address the situation. At the very least, people in positions of power who have rape charges against them should be removed as a condition of doing business. Now, that is something, I don't know how practical that would be, but I think there needs to be a very strong stance taken. I like the idea of U.S.-based companies having certain protocols by which they will do business with companies in other countries. I think also going back to, what companies in India can do, they need to have very, very strong policies in place that will not accept any kind of behavior that is detrimental to women's well-being, and take a role in changing the mindsets and attitudes of the people, of their employees.
Lisa writes via email to us. She makes an interesting point, interesting perspective here. She says, growing up in the 60s, we were often subjected to catcalls, hissing, whistling, etc. It was awful. My daughter, age 24, has experienced none of that. Men's behaviors here in the U.S. have changed profoundly. And she writes here also that women who traveled in Italy also remember frequent groping. That never happens now. There must be lessons to be learned. And she's wondering, what is it? Is it women's movement, pay equity, changing divorce laws? What? What can be done?
I think pay equity does go a long way, but I feel it is deeper than that. I'm happy that Lisa's daughter hasn't faced any of that here. But let's just look at the case in Ohio. They took a young woman from a party to party where she was assaulted, but most probably by the football team, and it took a blogger to actually talk about it. So, and again, coming back to 1 in 4 persons in the U.S. is going to be raped, I'm happy that there's people who are not going through it. But to say that generations, that it happened in the 60s and is not happening right now, is would mean that people like us would not be working, which I hope happens one day. a lot of people have spoken about this. I think we're all in consensus also. This begins at home. There is no they, quote and unquote. We talk about they need to do something. They need to change. We need to teach our children to that boys need to be respectful of women. Boys and girls need to be treated equally. We need to do this, lead by examples at home. I think that would make a huge difference. We have a very corrupt law enforcement system in India because of they're not paid very well. That needs to change because that plays out here. When people come here, they're scared of going to the police because of the experience they've had in home countries also. If we put in more money and change our laws a bit, and yes, absolutely change divorce laws, we will see a change.
I also think that we need to look at the role that media plays, especially in India, because women are just completely commodified, they are sexualized, and India is a deeply conservative and repressive society. It's a very repressed society. So you have these men who are watching women dancing about on the screen, they are just objects. We heard from a caller before, you know, that these women are expected to fall in love with the guy who's teasing them. So when they look at things like that and then they see, you know, a woman who they can attack, they do so. Their whole concept, it becomes very perverted and twisted of relationships with women. It regresses to that place of violence where they feel that the only way they can have a relationship with a woman is through violence.
Hang on to that thought, because we have a caller here who I think can offer some interesting perspective on that as well. Anand from Sunnyvale, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you. I came here to the U.S. for the first time when I was 22. And the comment I want to make is, you know, slightly represents the male perspective here. I think the deeply embedded cultural aspect are so deeply embedded that men don't even realize that they have a gender bias. They have a, you know, insensitive perspective. So the first time I ever received education on sexual harassment was when I came to the U.S. as a contractor for a U.S. company. So the point I'm alluding to is that kind of education on sexual harassment, on gender sensitivity, needs to happen on a widespread basis in India to sensitize men, to be aware that they have a certain predisposition.
Sonia, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have a couple, actually. He made a very good point about, you know, sensitizing men. And this actually goes to how cops treat women. One of the things we know is that a majority of the cops that work on the streets in big urban centers actually come from villages where people tend to be more conservative and women don't work. They stay in the house. They follow all the norms to the T. When these cops come from the villages to the city centers, there is nothing in their education, there is nothing in their training to help them bridge the gap between what they've been taught and what they know and what they see on the streets. Everything for them is shocking. Everything for them is, unbelievable and disgusting. And that is how, as a result, they treat the women who come into the police station to complain about any form of harassment. And so that sensitization has to take place at, you know, within the systems that we approach when we want to complain about sexual harassment. And it absolutely has to start at home. And you know, to the point of Bollywood, social media, as we all know, is very huge in India right now. And Bollywood stars are really big. They have millions of followers on Twitter. When they joined the outcry, everything turned on them. And people said, you know what? Shah Rukh Khan, who's the biggest star in Indian cinema, and others, stop thrusting your pelvis at women on screen. Stop using the B word and C word. And, you know, as was pointed out, stop showing these storylines in which women are initially sexually harassed. And by the end of the film, they are marrying their harasser.
At the beginning of your comments, you talked about how a lot of the cops come from villages. Is there a class difference? We have a listener who just wrote in, and this listener says, "We seem to be painting a real bad picture of Indian society. I would like to say that the class system and education play a large role in Indian society on how women are perceived. Educated Indian men don't behave badly with women. Of course, there are also some outliers like there are in any society. The status of women in India is bad. bad in lower rungs of Indian society, and this is where education, counseling, stricter laws, and support for women is urgently needed to help mend the situation. But I noticed, Sara and Shalini, when I was saying educated Indian men don't behave badly with women, quoting this listener, that you both kind of had a little smirk. You don't agree, obviously.
Yes. I mean, I can speak from the experience of, you know, women in India that domestic violence, for instance, cuts across all education and class barriers. And in fact, women who come from more affluent and educated backgrounds, if they are being harassed or beaten in the home, are even less likely to speak up about it because of the stigma. So they are in a part of society where the stigma is so great when your husband, who's a doctor, very well respected, is beating you up at home. So this is not, we have seen that, you know, it, I think in some ways in the lower economic strata, it is more evident because the woman feels more comfortable screaming and running out of her hut if she's being beaten. But an upper, so-called upper class and educated woman is more likely to remain silent. And, you know, the other thing that a lot of the groups that we work with in India do is to do sensitization trainings with the police, as we talked about earlier. They also work to set up women's cells in police stations, to have regular conversations with the police so that there is, you know, if something happens in the community, they can ensure an immediate reaction from the police. And these are all things that now, very belatedly, the Indian administration has been doing, even though they delayed for a number of weeks after this horrific incident. But as we've said before, it doesn't stop with just increasing the patrols or even sensitizing police. All of these things have to happen. And societal change, you know, will come about through all those things happening at the same time.
Sara, with the advocacy group Maitri, is there a class difference among South Asians here when it comes to sexual harassment?
Absolutely not. We have people we work with from physicians all the way to someone who may be monolingual and may not be working. So yes, domestic violence, whether in India or here, cuts across all class, which is for any sort of violence against women. Gender violence just has nothing to do with class or color or the socioeconomic status. Also wanted to say that none of us here is into India bashing. We were just pointing out about things that we went through, and we also talk about how it's happening across the globe. It's not just in India. But I also want to say, let's pause for a second and think, why are we talking about this now? Is it because the time is right? Why haven't we been protesting when all these little Dalit girls, for example, are being raped across the board every day, in fact, the same day in Delhi? We are threatened because this was, like you said, you know, someone from upper or a rising middle class, somebody who was studying, somebody who went to watch an English movie called Life of Pi. Then we feel that this is happening or could happen to our daughters. Was that the reason why we are having this? So that doesn't mean that this problem never existed in India.
Right. She doesn't have a name, but clearly a lot of women identify with her. Her name hasn't been revealed, rather, I should say. Let's go to our next caller who has been waiting very patiently, Babma from the South Bay. Thank you so much. Welcome to Forum.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. My name is Bhavna, and my comment about this discussion, and also I would like to hear what the ladies think about this, is that when a girl, we talked about what happens and how to stop that and how to cope with it and everything. But let's say, okay, a rape happens, and then the woman, what is the first thing that a woman does? She goes to her family for compassion, for any kind of, you know, to what to do, what should I do? She goes to her mother, her aunt, her all the women in the family who are related to her, who are her friends. You know, they are the first people who come in and, you know, like, tell her what has happened is, you know, not right. We're going to deal with this. We're going to do something about this. So I think the women around a woman who has been raped are the most powerful people, who are the first ones who are going to know or hear, because a woman feels more comfortable talking to a woman than anybody. And the organizations who come in to help come in at a later stage. The first thing that happens is at home. So I would like to say that, and the ladies would probably agree, that the women in the family really need to, you know, unite and say, you know, we're not going to question what has happened with you. We agree, we believe, and we're going to go take an action. So maybe when she has to go to the police station, it's not one woman going there and complaining. It's 10, 15, 20 saying that this is what has happened. We need an action. I think that can change probably, you know, on the first level, bring some change when the family, when the women around her unite. The unity in women is really required. That's what I would like to hear their reply.
Sonia, did you feel you had women you could talk to when you were in India, living there for 24 years and experiencing sexual harassment every day? It was like mealtime, you said.
Well, I heard a lot of stories, you know, but what kind of support could they offer me? The support that they offered was in listening to what I had to say and vice versa. And I was given the sort of advice that, you know, I shared in my New York Times op-ed, which was carry a safety pin, don't travel in the bus during rush hour. I had a friend who was actually studying to be a lawyer while she was working with me on this at this national news magazine. She used to carry a knife. She had been molested so many times, so brutally on the bus as well as in the trains when she was taking the overnight train back to her hometown of Bihar, that she started carrying a knife. And I remember telling her, you know, some days I can't carry a knife like you, because some days I'm so angry I will use it, or worse, it'll be used against me. But Bhavna makes an excellent point. You know, the lesson we must take from this is to say, certainly our systems, wherever we are in the world, judicial system, the police system, has to be revamped. We have to take a very close look at how they address these issues. But eventually, systems start with us, because systems comprise of people. So look within, whether you are a woman or a man or a community, look within and see how change can begin with you.
Shalini, any final comments?
Well,
real quickly?
My reaction was that, just from what I have seen in India, that very often a woman does not feel comfortable going to the women, the immediate women in her family and in her house. Now, I know that that has to change, but often that's the last place they will go. So they will go to an outside organization where they feel that they could get heard in a way that isn't just, you know, telling them to ignore what happened, or, you know, to try to brush it under the carpet.
Well, hopefully, and they can feel comfortable also going to an organization like Maitri as well. Thank you all for being with us on the program today. We were joined this hour by Sonia Falero, author of Beautiful Thing, Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bars. Sara Khan, program director for Bay Area-based Maitri, I should say, which helps South Asian survivors of domestic violence and human trafficking. And Shalini Nataraj, director of advocacy and partnerships with the Global Fund for Women. I'm Tui Vu.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.